Hey, Podnutsians. Welcome to Linux for the Rest of Us, episode 220. My name is Door-to-Door Geek, owner, operator, and nerd behind podnuts.com. This is a podcast where we try to talk about all things Linux for all people, not just administrators, but people who are brand new into it as well. First thing I got to talk about is the same thing I'm going to be talking about here for about 8 more months, because I would like to see a lot of people show up there, even if it's just to say hi or just to support the network. And that is TechCon Unplugged. TechCon Unplugged is a conference for computer repair owners and operators and people who just want to know more about how to fix computers, why to fix computers, how to turn it into a business. It is going to be on September 20th through the 22nd, Grand Rapids, Michigan. If you go to techconunplugged.com, you'll see a really nice looking site developed by Matt Rodella, who is going to be at the event. So if you need help with a website, A, he's the guy. B, he also offers a on-demand service where he can actually help host your website, generate content for it, and maintain all of the security updates for it as well. You can learn more about him at Computer Business Marketing Podcast, a really nice guy. If you register for the two-day event, it is $199. That includes every talk, every presentation, and food at the event, and including a special trip to Dave and Buster's, which is like right across the street. This is at the Holiday Inn at the Grand Rapids Airport. The event is in the exact same building, so you do not have to go far for the event. And we also have a discount code if you use United Airlines. So if you're going to fly in, it's definitely worth punching in that code and just seeing if you can save a couple bucks. I want to thank Jeff and Paco for all their effort in this event, and I really just want to try to be a part of it in any way I can, show them support, try to do everything I can to try to maybe make this event a little bit better. And I just got to fix this on the video stream. Oh, okay. Let's see if I can get this fixed in a reasonable amount of time without making the show go too long. With OBS, I completely forgot I changed some of the settings around while I was doing the makers, and I completely messed it up. So now there's just going to be a picture of the web page. Yeah, techconunplugged.com if you want to find out more information. Next link is actually going to be a link from the Mini PC Show archives, if you will. But I definitely think it is also for people who are fans of Linux, or you just need a second computer where you want the same kind of liberties and freedoms you get with your operating system. And what I mean by that is this is Oroid H2, the official American distributor for this hardware is over at ameridroid.com. Really good service. Customer service is top-notch kind of thing. This is a $112 board. The board is about 110 millimeters by 110 millimeters. Has baked into the board a Intel processor. It's not an i7 or an i9. I want to say it's an Intel Celeron, but now they're not called Celerons. It's, one newer than that is a Intel Celeron J4105 Gemini Lake processor baked onto it. So you're not going to change the processor on this board, but everything else on this mini computer is completely customizable. You have a NVMe slot on the bottom. You have dual RAM sockets on the bottom. You can add up to 32 gigs of RAM. The NVMe is M.2 SATA. On the top, you have a eMMC module, which is basically a small chip, same kind of hard drive that's in your phone or your tablet. You also have two full SATA ports, so you could easily turn this into a NAS-type device, some sort of network storage-type device. It also has dual gigabit Ethernet, so this could easily be a gateway-type device, like a PFSense-type device. So here's the real gimmick with this device that I really do like about it. And I did buy it right now. They're out of stock. They will come back into stock real soon. This is the perfect device if you want to build a system up how you see fit, but you can also use it to learn multiple aspects of computing and Linux. If you need a genuine gateway type router, you can simply install the correct operating system on it, connect the two NICs, and voila, you have true enterprise grade network monitoring and maintenance. Or you can hook up a couple SATA drives to it, and you can have a genuine network storage coming over a really fast network connections, and you can store terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of information. Or if you wanted really fast disk IO, you could hook up an NVMe drive to it. Or if you want a machine to just house a lot of virtual machine instances, you could have 32 gigs of RAM. So you could easily have 60 plus virtual machines launched on this thing, and it will run just fine. This to me is one of the best bang for the buck things I've ever purchased in my life. Odroid has been around a while. They do really good stuff is what I'm going to say. They rarely have anything that's a dud. This is definitely one of their better devices is what I'm going to say. Zero issues with it. Really good customer service from this website. And if your goal is to run Linux in all different configurations because you want to learn stuff, it's harder to find a better machine for this price is what I'm going to say. I've been looking for years for a device with a true dual gig NIC on it and it being a smaller form factor. And I finally have it. I was really hoping it would be about $100 or less. 112 is basically, I think, as close as anyone's going to be able to get for any length of time, any time in the future. So this is definitely well worth the money as far as I'm concerned. Again, all the links are in the notes. We at Podnuts at least try to add as much to the notes as possible. Everything that I'm going to talk about in this episode, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure it is in the notes, and it will be in chronological order. So as the show goes on, you can go down in the notes. This next link is from Linux Journal. And I saw this and it really did make me think. Because I'm a parent, of course, I've been thinking a lot about schools and the fact that that they're called public schools. I don't like that. They're not public schools. They're government schools. They're ran by the government. They're owned by the government. Everybody working in them are basically government employees in one shape, way, or fashion. Either they're contracted out, but they're government employees, unless you send your kids to a private school. And if you can send your kids to a actual private school, congratulations, because I can't come close to affording it. But there is, I think, something to be said of what is being taught in the school. Should there be an honest effort to make everything being taught, everything in the school, to be more open source? And it's the kind of thing, instinctually, I think everyone would have to say absolutely yes to. But I do understand that the businesses behind it, the businesses supplying these schools, have their own things they have to worry about. So I can understand not getting everything all the time without question open source, but I always think that there's room for negotiation and there's room for bartering, because I do believe even before I had kids, I was okay with paying taxes into schools, because my logic was I didn't want to go to a convenience store, or I didn't want to go someplace and have to interact with people who are unbelievably undereducated. I would much rather have the general public be more educated than less. And I do believe with more open source initiatives inside of the government institution of schooling, I do think we would all see better results and we would all have better experiences with the school. This was actually a pretty interesting article. They talked about a couple other countries and like what they were doing. This is by Glenn Moody, February 4th, 2019. And I'll say this, the one big reason I like open source in schools is I want to teach my children about technologies, not about individual products. So I think that's one of those things that I don't think a lot of non-techs completely understand. They want their kids to learn Microsoft Office, or they want their kids to learn about an iPad or whatever. I want my kids to try to understand basic technology. which is not easy. Not easy at all. And honestly, I don't envy anybody who is a teacher in a public school. Nothing they do is simple. Nothing they do is easy. Unfortunately, they're government employees. That's probably a little bit by design, but I know the ones that I've met have genuine, honest effort and desire to try to do the best thing possible. I will agree with Milton Friedman, economist. And he said, you know, virtually every government employee wants to do the best that they possibly can. They are a government employee first and foremost because they think they are working for the greater good. And being a government employee, I can definitely vouch for that. When I took the job and every day I keep the job, it isn't because I want to work for the government. It's because I want to help the taxpayer get more out of their money. And this is the kind of thing where I could see it being directly beneficial to entire generations ahead of us. If you think I'm right or if I'm thinking you're wrong, don't hesitate to shoot me an email. And speaking of email, I'm actually reading email now. I actually got some email things working. I will thank Martin Rambo Obando. He's the man. He definitely helped me a little bit with some configurations and some plugins with Thunderbird. I will say, I'm not entirely getting off Google just yet, but you have to start someplace. So the logic to me is, first and foremost, I need to separate out all my emails and I need to have a dedicated client in order to address these emails. So here is the email we have from Skip. And it says, I'm glad to see Linux for the Rest of Us is back publishing on a regular basis. I recently launched my own Linux-based blog at cvilfoss.blog.live, I believe. There will be a link to it in the notes. Cvilfoss.blog. I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, hence my name. Okay, Skip. I don't understand that. Okay. Oh, Cville Falls, the name of the blog. Gotcha. I'm a little slow, Skip. My focus is on advertising self-employed professionals and small business on how to incorporate Linux and Falls into their own work. And I myself am a self-employed legal writer. Regarding your discussion of Home Bank on episode 219, I would like to suggest another nice piece of a accounting software for Linux. For many years, I've used a command line tool called hledger.org to do all my business bookkeeping. I plan to do a series of posts about it on Cville Falls in February. Hledger basically prepares reports based on plain text journal files. Hledger also has a tool for making the journal entries. What I like about this approach is the journal file does not depend on some third party or proprietary format like QIF, which I believe is a QuickBooks format. So I never lose access to my raw financial data. I will try to have a link to both of these in the notes. I gotta remember to bookkeep it after the show. And here's the whole gimmick. Keeping data in raw files like that actually open up your freedom immensely, because now if an application or an interface does not do something that you like, you can use other tools like simple text editors. You can use tools like Notepad++ on Windows, and you can import the data, open it up, and you can modify it in such a way to make it more approachable for other formats. So if you want to take the raw format, add this dedicated column, it's actually not difficult. Or if you want to make special columns, or if you want to just get rid of these three columns and then put everything into an Excel spreadsheet or a spreadsheet, it is actually super easy once you understand the basics of it when you have a raw data file. So that's really interesting. And a command line tool, to be honest, the reason I like a command line tool is because then it allows me to customize my own interfaces to it. I might actually be able to link it up to like a Twitter DM. So anytime I'm out and about, I can just private DM a special account that I create, and it can automatically add things into that back in my home base. So I definitely like the idea that I will have to take a peek at it. I will try to have a link to both of these in the notes. Seville Foss and H. Ledger. Thank you very much, Skip. Thank you very much for the email, and thank you very much for the support. If you would like to send an email, it is very easy. podcast@lennoxfortherestofus.com, or you can just go to podnest.com, click on the shows, and click on contact, and then you can contact us that way as well. The next couple links are all kind of related, and the first one is from ZDNet with insane ads and auto-playing video all over the place that I had to mute because it's really annoying, and it is free software, made it on laptops, but IoT future is bleak. And the next one, I believe, is ZDNet as well, with another auto-running video, which is really annoying. Bringing open source Rhyme and Reason to Edge Computing, LF Edge. Okay, here's the whole gimmick, okay? IoT just is the smart light switches and the smart little appliance-type devices. And open source free software is not making it into those devices because those companies, those industries, they insist on utter control of these things. Because of that, we are not getting much free software choices on it. Now, if you have an honest effort and you would like to have free software on it, it's actually very easy to do. You just have to take a little bit more responsibility and build it up yourself and not just expect to open a box and have open source. You can buy chips like the ESP 3266, I want to say. Very small form factor chips, very low power chips. There are entire kernels where you basically just put the kernel on and you're given a base version of Python, and then you can basically code anything you want on top of it, a web server, turn on switches, turn off switches because of time or because of some external thing, and then you can basically control your entire IoT infrastructure, but you're not going to be able to walk into a Best Buy or a big department store and buy a device with IoT open source stuff on it for you to edit. That is unfortunate, but that is the way everything is going. And the second link about edge computing, all this is going to be meshed together. The two constants in computing is nothing stays the same. The other constant is nothing ever completely goes away. We're always going to have super old technology somewhere, whether it's a dot matrix printer or a mainframe. We're always going to have them. Even BBSs have a purpose someplace, and they always will, because that's how computers work. Well, edge computing, you have to think, what if on the edge of my network, in my house or my company or my work, we had these devices really close to the internet, so they had really quick connections and they had really small, quick processors on them with caches of data on them. So hypothetically, you're at work, an email goes out, you have to do this training, and this training is done on the public internet. Well, if you have a smart edge computer, that edge computer can be notified and it can cache and it can keep checking and it can update. But with edge computing, you can actually do a lot more calculation type things. It is basically trying to move the smart infrastructure out of your phone and out of your laptop and pushing it into the network itself, and thus squashing the cloud down and pushing it towards the edges is the only way I can describe it. Edge computing is going to make a lot of companies a hell of a lot of money here in the next couple of years, because if we can get lag time down with better networks, and everyone keeps talking about 5G, and 5G is still nothing more than a hoax, it's going to cost incredible amounts of money and will not give its us the power that, to be quite frank, that they're promising us, but it will be better, is what I'll say. It does have the potential to be better. But with that kind of speed and low latency, it can make edge computing much, much more desirable. Thus, more developers will go to it, more hardware will go to it. And then, you know, 3 to 5 years, we could actually see some genuine progress on it. In the same kind of retrospect about how things are going, once in a while, we have to stop and say, where did things come from? This to me was an absolute glorious write-up, January 28th by DHH, no idea who the hell that is, on signalvnoise.com, paying tribute to the web with ViewSource. This is a really good write-up where he's basically going back through what it meant, how opening and how freeing and how liberating literally it was, how back in the day you could go to any web page at any point in time and you could click view source and you had the world's information at your fingertips. You could look at it all, you could copy it, you could take it down on your server, you could try to manipulate it, and you had the open opportunity to learn anything that was being displayed on the public internet, and you had your own opportunity to make it better. Now, you can still today do a lot of view sourcing, but I will say it seems like a lot of things now are doing a certain amount of complexity, just trying to obfuscate stuff, not because they have to, but because it might be harder for somebody else to copy is what it seems like, or I'm just getting old. Okay, I'm getting old no matter what, but I think that they're honestly obfuscating a little bit on purpose. You can still do it. It just requires a little bit more work, but I think we have to recognize how simple it was, how utterly, utterly simple it was back in the day to simply Alt-VC view source, and then voila, we could see all the code running on that web page at any point in time. And we really did as end users have the exact same power as virtually any website that was out there. That was a really glorious time in personal development opportunities, as far as I'm concerned. The next one I'm bringing to the show just because I'm shocked. I'm literally shocked. Pharonix.com. Awesome 4.3 window manager brings better DPI handling and widget improvements. I honestly didn't think there was an update on the awesome window manager for like 4 years. This was published January 28th, 2019. So apparently they are still doing updates to the awesome Windows manager. I've been using i3 on most of my devices here for the last year. And to be honest, there was two reasons though, geez. One, I didn't think they were doing any damn updates. So why would I keep using it? But really, the real reason was, from everything I was reading in the tea leaves, if you will, Awesome was not looking at doing any Wayland type upgrading. So when the display managers and everything went off of Xorg and went to Wayland, which is a back-end technology that's taken a while, but sooner or later, everything on Linux is going to be on this graphics engine, if you will, called Wayland. And then Awesome doesn't look like it's going to work, so I better start use something that will work, and i3 already does work on Wayland. So I jumped to that desktop manager thinking I was going to have no choice to do it sooner or later, so I might as well make it myself. So I'm going to keep looking at Awesome, because to be quite honest, Awesome did absolutely everything I needed to. i3 is as well, but it's always good to have options available to you. And here's the real reasons I like Awesome and i3. I don't have to touch the mouse. I love when I can do 80%+ to 90%+ of everything I'm going to do on my computer and never touch the mouse. A mouse is a very non-intuitive interface for computing. It is a nicety in the fact you don't have to touch the screen, so you can always see what you're clicking, but it's always off on the side, and you can get them with 20 buttons on them now, and they have different sensitivities. I think they're overcomplicating everything. With i3 and Awesome, I can do almost everything with just the keyboard, and it really is empowering to have that. So most of the pretty desktops, I really don't gravitate towards. I can use them, but I never am efficient at any of them, and it's because there's way too much screen waggling going on, like with the mouse. You got to go over here, click over there. So I'm going to keep an eye on it. Hopefully Awesome will get its proper support for Wayland, but it isn't there quite yet. And again, on like the privacy kind of side of computing, it is why no one really quits Google or Facebook. And it's an article. They definitely bring up some good points. There actually is an old, I want to say Roman, might be Greek, because I get them all confused. Greek cognitive bias, where people thought, well, if we just educated people all at the same level, then everybody would agree about certain facts. And it's been thus since then proven incredibly, unbelievably inaccurate to believe that. I mean, we know today in 2019, if we show 10 people the same two paragraphs, if there's anything in there that hits those emotional triggers, everyone will read it completely different, whether it's abortion, gun control, races, sports, sports franchises, sports teams, nationalities, any kind of anything with a political edge to it or a tribalism edge to it, like sports teams, they will read it how they want to. Facts are irrelevant to feelings. So why are people still on Google or Facebook? Because why not? I mean, is the real thing. Why are people not on Friendster anymore? Well, because they moved to MySpace. Why aren't people on MySpace anymore? Well, because they moved to Facebook. So if you ask, why are they still on Google and Facebook? Google and Facebook can do everything wrong, and they will do everything wrong, but people will still be on them until something over 100% better exists and has an easy transition period to it. See, back in 2012, it only had to be better. Now in 2019, better is not close to enough, because there's a pain of transition that comes along with it, where you have your 2,000 friends on Facebook, where, you know, you actually probably only know 10 of them, but your 2,000 friends on Facebook, you then have to convince all them to also migrate off Facebook. Or you could just be an adult and walk away and say, I don't need those 2,000 friends. I'll just put a little notice up and say, I'm going over here. And if you want to come, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. Treat people like an adult as far as I'm concerned. But this definitely at least got the juices flowing, got me thinking about what's it going to take, because we've had all kinds of privacy issues. We've had all kinds of information leakage issues. We've had all kinds of actions that at least look to be immoral and unethical. And it hasn't made a blip in the number of active users on their networks. And then fools out there believe, well, that's just because those people don't really understand what's going on. I don't think you understand. It's not that they don't understand. It's that they don't care. People openly give up privacy for convenience. Convenience is the American way. We love convenience, and we will take it trumping everything else. And yes, sorry if I just triggered you by saying Trump, but we will always give up convenience in lieu of whatever it is. Something tasty, something shiny, something pretty, something that makes us feel better, whatever. We'll always give up security in favor of convenience, and that's just how we are. So for something to come across to actually make a significant change, it's literally going to have to be even more groundbreaking and immensely better than what was before. And that's just, you know, that's just how I personally see it. Next one is about an individual on medium.com, how I'm slowly moving off the cloud with Nextcloud. Okay, well, obviously that's not a good title. How I'm slowly moving off the public cloud to a private cloud with Nextcloud. That's how it should be titled. Okay, and there's no secrets amongst us here. We know what you can do with Nextcloud. And I'll just say this, with the plugin architecture and with the stuff coming to Nextcloud, it's only getting better is what I'm going to say. Okay, the functionality keeps improving and keeps getting better over time. The lead dev in Nextcloud deserves a big tip of the hat. In fact, I got to see if he has a Patreon, because I'll give him money every month. I don't want to give him money once. I want to keep giving him money and keep giving him money. The main reason I'm linking to this one is because he shows you how to basically install it onto your Raspberry Pi, which I will say, you install a PHP type front end web server on a Raspberry Pi, I hope you are also at least mildly patient, because it will not be fast or snappy. A Raspberry Pi for $35 is not the end all be all of computing. It's just one of them. So if you just want to dip your toe in, see if it's worth it, get a Raspberry Pi. If it does seem like it's worth it, but the performance isn't really making you happy, let me know. mail@ponix.com. I'll definitely help you out. But, I like it because he goes through some of the issues he had, and these are not issues I had with setting up my Nextcloud. He has his outside domain name service being hosted by Google. So he basically has to take you through his dynamic DNS setup to use Google. No matter what, it is still an educational link, and there's definitely really good information on it as well. Even if you do your dynamic DNS in a different way. And all that means is, if it is a hypothetical door-to-door geek.podnuts.com, where is that record stored that tells everybody else's browser when you type that in where, what server that you need to go to? With a dynamic DNS, My home IP address can change every day. But if I have it set up correctly, every day you'll be able to go to that domain name and you'll always come back down into my network, even though the IP addresses change. That's what you can get with a dynamic DNS. And it really does make it much simpler and easier to actually host yourself and own the data, own the connection all yourself. This guy goes into blistering detail, is the way I'll put it, showing everything that he's doing to set up everything from the static IP, doing the basic install, doing the basic configuration, and so forth and so on. Really good write-up, really clean write-up, really easy to understand write-up as well. The one thing I will say is, whenever I've set up a static IP address inside of a Raspberry Pi or Raspbian operating system, I haven't had great success. And he even says in his article, if your router has the capability of doing a DHCP reservation, do that. It's much easier. It is much easier, but everyone's router is different. So you got to know how to do that. So if you're trying to do it at your home and you need any help, don't hesitate. Shoot me an email. I'll definitely help you out, because there is simple ways to communicate what needs to be done. But basically, you want to be able to say, this is my MAC address of my Raspberry Pi. You router, when you see this MAC address pop up, you always give it this IP address, period. It is very easy to do and very effective when you have it set up right. A couple more quick links. The first one, I really don't get. I really don't understand. I never heard of it before, and it's on a website right now with tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of ads on Tom's Hardware. Tom'sHardware.com. They have some fantastic write-ups. Their forums spur lots of really good conversations. I'm sure there's a bunch of nice people behind it as well, but if any site needs an ad, needs like an ad blocker in 2019, I'm pretty sure it's Tom's Hardware now. It's really bad. But this link got my eye. It was Intel releasing a open source encoder for the next gen AV1 codec. I ain't never heard of no AV1 codec, and not that I'm a specialist or whatever, and I should be hearing about this, but I've never heard of it. I will say this: we always need better codecs in the open source world, only because we keep wanting quality and quality better, and our speeds are not going as fast as our desire. So we need better software optimization in the transcoding and encoding of multimedia into smaller file sizes, but still giving us great results in the other end. And I love hearing Intel do this kind of thing. Intel is the kind of company I have very mixed feelings about in the past. They've done some really stupid stuff in the past. But I will say they've done some great things in the past as well, especially towards open source and for Linux and for Clear Linux and for Ikey and other people I consider to be up in the Oregon area. Some of the smartest people I've met and some of the nicest people I met work for Intel. So they have good hiring practices from what I can tell, and they do good things like this, and they do open source a good amount of stuff. So if they're coming out the new next gen AV1 codec, hopefully that means it's going to be picked up by other people and actually accepted as like one of the future format types. One more link, and it's going to come with a little hesitation. I don't really know what I think about this yet, except, and to quote Nightwise, I'll just say interesting. Because when you see something good or bad, and as a Belgian, he said, you really don't know if the person you're saying this to is going to all of a sudden take over your country. So you don't want to offend them. So you just say interesting. Or if you like treat them too good, and then the person who hates him takes over your country, they'll remember that you said something good to them. So you want to say something as impartial as like possible. And that word is typically interesting. So this is very, very interesting. It is called PipeWire, pipewire.org. Basically, PipeWire is a multimedia processing stack, is the best way I can put it. Their contrast on their page sucks and it's really hard to read, but it's PipeWire is a project that aims to greatly improve handling of audio and video under Linux. It aims to support the use cases currently handled by both Pulse Audio and Jack. At the same time, provide same level of powerful handling of video input and output It also introduces a security model that makes interacting with audio and video devices from containerized applications easy, with support Flatpak applications being the primary goal. Alongside Wayland and Flatpak, we expect Pipewire to provide a core building block for the future of Linux application development. That last sentence is quite damn powerful, is what I want to say. There are people that like Jack. There are people that hate Jack. There are people that like Pulse. There are people that hate Pulse. There are people that like the older, like OSS and those tools, and there are people that hate them. I'll just say this. They do have an opportunity to make improvements that we don't have right now. But to making that kind of statement is a really, really bold statement. You know, and I know that this will become something real once we hear big name distros, whether it's Fedora, SUSE, Ubuntu, Debian, blah, 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 starting switching this over to the default. When we start to hear that, then we know this thing has made genuine headway and is doing something right. For right now, I can tell you they sound like they know what the hell they're doing. And I'm going to expect in about less than a year and a half, we're going to start hearing some distros that are using this. And the one thing that I really like is, if you keep scrolling down, it says features include capture and playback of audio and video with minimal latency, real-time multimedia processing on audio and video. Real-time manipulation of multimedia is one of the things that people really do desire. And when I say people, I don't mean people. I mean professionals and industries really desire to have that fine-grained, instantaneous manipulation, whether it is they want to add reverb, or they want to get rid of noise, or they want to jack this EQ up, or they want to turn this down, or they want to DS this, or they want to whatever. Well, DS is still an EQ thing. So people and industries insist on having near zero latency on their device. I will say right now you can easily make it, which is just downloading from and building from source, which can be a little bit hair-raising kind of thing. They do have some documentation over at the Pipewire wiki. So if you're an audio guy and you want to play with this, I definitely think it would actually be fun. I'm also going to put a link in here to a Pharonix where they're looking at Pipewire, and they're thinking it should be one of the exciting Linux desktop technologies for 2018. And I'll say this, we can never have too many exciting technologies in the Linux desktop, because we sure in the hell didn't have a lot of them in 2018. So I'm really looking forward to this, just for the simple fact it actually might shake some stuff up and make people stop and think, or might make people stop and realize, or might make people just want to use Linux more. Any single time we as a community can help spur innovation, and we can push anybody in any industry to like Linux and use Linux, and then turn to somebody else in the industry and say, what do you mean you're not using Linux? That's when we win as end users, because every time we get more people on this platform, we get the rewards from it. Yes, Dell does, Red Hat does, IBM does, the Linux Foundation does, in some cases Microsoft does. Yes, all these other people also get their rewards for it. But right now, I believe still in 2019, us end users are still the primary receiver of this goodwill, of these things changing, of these things getting better. I will say, do not forget, if you want to send us an email, you can send it at podcast@Linux for the rest of us. If you would like to watch us live, it is also in the notes. I'm still not on a hard schedule for doing the show, but I will get better. There's also contact information in the notes for email and voicemail. If you would like to send us a voicemail, you can simply call us at 7076-PODNUT. And I want to thank everyone for their support. I want to thank everyone for all their feedback. And do not forget, do not ever forget, if you do not have root, then you do not know who does. Thanks, everybody.